This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's going nowhere at the moment. Less than a handful of Democratic senators have stepped up to join Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold's call to censure the president for warrantless wiretapping in America. Republicans love to talk about it, mainly to beat up on Democrats as disloyal to the commander-in-chief. And yet there is a hard kernel of concern over law and the balance of powers and the power of the presidency that doesn't go away. In Senate hearings Friday, the shadow of Watergate was back. In testimony of John Dean, a top Reagan attorney blasted Bush, and a top Clinton attorney stoutly defended the president. They're all with us today. John Dean, Bruce Fine, John Schmidt. Up next on Point, the case for and against censuring George W. Bush. We turn first to Gail Chadwick. She covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and joins us from Washington. Gail, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Hearings on Friday, but where does this motion stand? Is it indeed going anywhere at all?
Well, I don't think the motion is going anywhere. The committee may vote on it. It may yet come to a vote on the Senate floor. It's certain to go down. But what's interesting is the issues that the censure motion keeps alive, which is, did the president violate the law? Apparently, yes. But was there a constitutional basis for doing so? That is the kind of question that historians go back, 30 years later and say, how did Congress act at this time? In a sense, the hearings on Friday were more for the history books than for what's going to happen next week.
Gil, there are politics running all over this censure motion, but how do they look now? Democrats, by and large, have run away from Russ Feingold's motion, their colleague's motion here. Republicans have said, let's talk about it, and kind of used it to hit the Democrats over the head. How are the politics of this unfolding?
I think you stated them perfectly. Republicans responded to this exactly the way they did to John Murtha's call last December for an immediate withdrawal from Iraq. They called for a very quick vote, confident that Democrats would not support it and he would be isolated. That is what would happen to Senator Feingold if he did it as well. But back of that, there's the larger question of where the president stood in terms of a monarchical president, in effect. And how do people feel about that? Look closely at what Republicans on the committee said. Senator Spector said that the motion was not frivolous, but also he couldn't support it. But this is the fourth hearing he's held on NSA intercepts. He wants the issue to go on. He wants the FISA court, the Court on Foreign Intelligence that was set up in a 1978 law, to review what the president did. Senator Graham, also on the committee, very aggressively opposed censure, but wants the FISA law set right with what the president is doing. If it needs revising, he said, the president should come to the Congress and propose revisions. Republicans, although they're not as vocal, are just as concerned as some of the Democrats over what's happening with the Constitution here. They don't want to be irrelevant in war or any other time, especially a war that looks like it has no end in sight.
So, Gail, are you saying that even the GOP is kind of writing the backdraft of this little censure effort? Senator Spector has, as you say, proposed reining in the NSA program, or at least getting some congressional hook into it, some kind of mandate of oversight.
I think that is exactly what they're doing. Understand, they absolutely don't support the censure motion. They think it sends a very bad message to the rest of the world at a time of war. However, there are very few institutionalists left in the Congress, people who really defend congressional prerogatives. They're not there to become president or to move on to another job. They really want Congress to function. And Senator Spector is one of those people. He doesn't want to let it stand that a sitting president could simply ignore a law of Congress.
And out in the political hustings, Republicans really making hay with this, saying if the Democrats win in the fall, they will bring impeachment to Capitol Hill.
This is Republicans couldn't have asked for anything better. The only issue they have a very strong shot at mobilizing their base on is not the budget. It's not the war, but but it is the sense of a president who is willing to defend national security at home. Katrina, and especially the ports debacle, really cut into that. And the idea that Democrats, by overreaching, could revive this issue and mobilize the base who are angry that the president would be censured at a time of war. Republicans couldn't have paid for this kind of publicity.
Are Democrats, meanwhile, quietly grinding their teeth? Bill Clinton was brought up on impeachment charges over Monica Lewinsky. It seems like a different scale of issue, wherever you stand on it.
I think, it's interesting. As you sat through the Friday hearings, you heard echoes of two clashes with presidents, certainly with John Dean there. You heard Watergate. There was even an extraordinary exchange between Senator Graham and John Dean. Did you authorize the break-in at Watergate? Mm-hmm. Did the president? And you felt like you were in a time war.
1972 all over again. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But the same thing with impeachment of President Clinton. There were several moments in that hearing when people said, the president is not above the law. We don't want a monarchical president. No man is above the law. Well, those are precisely what Senator Graham and Hatch said during the impeachment trial. So those issues are echoing on both sides.
Gil Chadwick, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Gil Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with us from Washington. We are talking this hour about the case for and the case against censuring President Bush for wiretapping phone conversations and emails in America without a court warrant. You can join the conversation. Do you argue for or against censure? And what do you hear in the debate, politics or principle? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles, he was in Washington on Friday, is John Dean, former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon and author of the book Worse Than Watergate, The Secret Presidency of George W. Bush. John Dean became the star whistleblower in the Watergate hearings, and he himself was charged with obstruction of justice and spent 4 months in prison for his role in the Watergate cover-up. John Dean, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
What's the essential case you made on Friday?
I tried to make the institutional case. I'm not really a partisan in this, and really don't look upon censure as a partisan, although it has a partisan history. Gail made a very good point that there's a lot of concern about censuring a president in time of war. That shows how slack our history is, or knowledge of history, which I saw repeatedly during this session. For example, Richard Nixon urged the censure of Harry Truman when he fired MacArthur. It couldn't have been more of a time of war. So you can't. We find people on both sides of this issue, and I really think it's important that the Congress not let the president just willy-nilly go off and violate the law. I happened to start my career on Capitol Hill. I was there when Lyndon Johnson was in office. I watched a Democratic Congress keep a Democratic president in line. I believe that's the way the system was designed to work. And since Republicans have taken control, there is absolutely no oversight whatsoever. And I think this is about as good a starting point as you could find.
You wrote Worse Than Watergate before any of this even unfolded. So did you come in predisposed to want to hit this president?
Well, I make a very strong case in Worse Than Watergate that indeed it is worse than Watergate. And it's far predated the NSA wiretaps. They're not included in the book. I felt the case was fairly persuasive before we even got to this because I saw a pattern very early, Tom. It was a pattern of secrecy. They were going down the same path that we'd gone down. The people on Capitol Hill don't seem to understand what happens down in that bubble at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and how easy it is to get caught up in your own self-righteousness down there. And every now and then it's good to poke that bubble, and censure is one of those things that I mentioned on Friday. Had it happened during Watergate, would have been a godsend.
Let's listen to just a little bit of the senators from Friday. Here's Wisconsin Democrat Russ Feingold challenging the legal theory the Bush administration uses to justify its NSA wiretapping program.
Under this theory, we no longer have a constitutional system consisting of three co-equal branches of government. We have a monarchy. We can fight terrorism without breaking the law. The rule of law is central to who we are as a people, and the president must return to the law. He must acknowledge and be held accountable for his illegal actions and also for misleading the American people both before and after the program was revealed. If we in the Congress don't stand up for ourselves and for the American people, we become complicit in the lawbreaking. A resolution of censure is the appropriate response, even a modest approach.
The return was quick and hard. South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham claimed that Senator Feingold's censure resolution is a danger to American national security.
The idea of censuring the president for surveilling the enemy after notifying Congress is, to me, is way beyond what would be appropriate and would have the effect of killing the program. And I think that would be a very big mistake for our country to kill this program, because it is, in my opinion, necessary in the war on terror to find out what the enemy's up to, and this seems to be a reasonable way to find out what they're doing. Senator Feingold sees this as a obvious violation of the law by the president deserving rebuke. I do not see it that way at all. I see it a confusing, uncertain area of the law that deserves thought and collaboration.
What's your thought? Let's collaborate here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined by John Dean, former White House counsel to President Richard Nixon. We're joined right now from Chicago by John Schmidt, former Associate Attorney General of the U.S. United States in the Clinton administration. He's currently a partner at Mayer Brown Rowe and Maugham in Chicago, defended George W. Bush stoutly in the hearings on Friday. John Schmidt, thank you for being with us.
It's good to be here.
And from Washington by Bruce Fine. He was Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan administration. He's currently practicing law as a founding partner at Fine and Fine. He was Republican counsel during the Iran-Contra hearings. He was a sharp critic of Bush administration moves and spoke in the censure corner on Friday. Bruce Fine, thank you for being here.
Delighted to be with you.
John Schmidt, give us your best defense here. You heard Feingold there in the tape. You heard John Dean begin to unroll his case. Give us the heart of your defense of the president, please.
I think the president did have the legal authority under the Constitution to authorize the NSA program, even though it was in violation of the FISA Act. I think people talk about violating the law, but the question is whether that law was constitutional insofar as it limited the president's authority in this area. And the president has said, General Hayden has said, that he relied upon the opinions of the Justice Department, opinions of lawyers at the NSA, that he had the constitutional authority to act. And in fact, there's only one judicial statement on this issue. That's from a three-judge court. It's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review, a long name. That's the court that reviews the FISA court. That court in 2002 looked at this issue, said the president has the inherent constitutional authority under Article 2 to carry out electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes, and then it said Congress in the FISA Act could not encroach upon that presidential power. That it's not the Supreme Court of the United States, but it's three federal judges, and they are the only judges who have ever spoken to this issue.
But can the president, can the White House override a standing law on a court statement like that? Isn't it for the courts, maybe the highest court, to determine whether or not the president can step past FISA?
No, we have a longstanding tradition in this country through successive administrations that the president can make an independent constitutional judgment on whether a statute unconstitutionally encroaches upon his power. In fact, that was asserted very strongly in the Clinton administration by Walter Dellinger, who was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, when President Clinton actually took the position that he would not enforce provisions of a statute that directed him to discharge from the Army anybody who was HIV positive. He actually signed the law into effect, but said, based upon his independent constitutional judgment, it was unconstitutional and he would not enforce it. Mm. So there's nothing startling, although obviously it only happens rarely and should happen only rarely, about a president saying, this law unconstitutionally encroaches upon my authority, and therefore, because I have the right and the obligation to carry out my responsibilities under the Constitution, I will not follow the provisions of this law. Mm.
Let me turn to Bruce Fine. Mr. Fine, John Dean comes out of the Nixon White House, John Schmidt out of the Clinton White House, and here defending President Bush. You come to us from a service in the Reagan administration, and yet you were a very stern critic of the president on Friday. Why?
Because I believe the rule of law ought to trump the president. Let me elaborate on why I think Mr. Schmidt's argument is exceptionally anemic. First of all, the administration itself, in its white papers, has not claimed inherent constitutional power to override FISA. It is said it might have that power, but it's relying upon a different theory, namely that the authorization to use military force enacted in the aftermath of 9/11 justifies what the president is doing. But the critical understanding here is the power of Congress to regulate all authorities vested in the United States under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 of the U.S. Constitution. That is, Congress can regulate the powers conferred on any of the three branches of government, presidential, judicial, or legislative. Now, the president concededly has authority to gather foreign intelligence, but Congress has equally the authority to regulate the way in which foreign intelligence is gathered. What FISA does is not tell the president you can't gather foreign intelligence in times of war. It simply says if the gathering includes targeting American citizens on American soil, you must get a FISA warrant showing probable cause to believe that the American is implicated in terrorist activity or is a lone wolf terrorist.
What if it's the White House's opinion that that getting that FISA warrant would slow down the process or somehow make it ineffective in ways that we may not even fully understand?
Then it has an obligation to go to the Congress and ask that the statute be amended. But one of the things that you need to understand is 8 months after this warrantless surveillance program began, it was the Bush Justice Department went to the Senate Intelligence Committee on July 31st, 2002, and said, FISA is working beautifully. We're able to enact nimbly and swiftly in response to impending terrorist threats, and therefore we don't need any amendments. This is the Bush administration 8 months after the warrantless surveillance program began. The Bush administration refuses to explain to Congress how it is that FISA is unworkable in a post-9/11 world. It has refused to disclose to Congress the legal advice the president allegedly received that Mr. Schmidt refers to right after 9/11 that purports to justify his constitutional authority to undertake this program. And if you examine as well the legal theory upon which Mr. Schmidt extrapolates from Article 2, this is what it means. The president can use any power he thinks is necessary to gather foreign intelligence. If the law prohibits mail openings and mail openings can gather foreign intelligence, the president can flout the law. If the president needs to break and enter homes without a FISA warrant, despite FISA's instruction to the contrary, he can break and enter homes. If the president needs to commit torture, he thinks, in order to gather foreign intelligence, the president can violate the torture statute.
Is that the monarch that Russ Feingold is describing in your
view? Yes, exactly. And when the president has been asked, well, what is it in your theory that prohibits you from undertaking these measures, the attorney general and the president have never said, I don't have authority to do that. All they've said is, we aren't doing it yet.
Would Ronald Reagan have taken these steps in defense of the country, Bruce Fine, you served in his
administration? No, he would have gone to Congress and asked for any change in the law. When I served with Mr. Cheney on the Iran-Contra Committee, and we were critical of the Boland Amendment and hand efforts by Congress to tie the president's authority to deal with Latin American problems, we never said it was unconstitutional. We criticized the policy. But that's quite different from saying the president can override and ignore the statute simply because he disagrees with it.
But Mr. Cheney defends it ardently. Now, Bruce Fine, John Schmidt, John Dean, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in. Jefferson's calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Jefferson. You're on the air.
Good morning. Gentlemen, I think that this is really an issue of the president being both a little too big for his britches and just really out of touch with the people that he's supposed to be serving, and that's about service. And really, just those two things, he just usurps power that it crosses a line. If he'd gone to Congress and asked Congress, you know, can we change these rules? Can we? I think it would be totally different. I think the American people would view it differently.
But Jefferson, the Republicans and other defenders say, look, we've got a real security issue on our hands right now. Don't be plaguing the president with something like this, a censure motion.
Well, I don't know that it's really a matter of plaguing him or hurting American security. If you break the law, you need to go back and address that. I would really like to see him do that, and I'd like to see him own up to some mistake sometime. I know that he's not a perfect administration, but
John Dean, let me turn to you off of Jefferson's observation here. You saw an administration that, in the Nixon administration, that put itself in a kind of unique position vis-a-vis the law. How do you compare these two? You were inside there. You're very outside now. But you say you see similar dynamics, history repeating itself.
Well,
your words,
actually, I had very good sources when I wrote Worse Than Watergate as from the inside, people who are concerned on the inside. And let me just say that the Nixon administration thought many of its actions, which got very mangled up on the Hill on Friday, thought their actions were being driven by national security. Nixon was wiretapping without warrants for national security reasons. He was trying to run down leaks. He was wiretapping his staff, his reporters, and what have you. These were warrantless wiretaps. He had gone to court and tried to get the court to approve them and had been turned down by the courts. This is pre-FISA. This is one of the reasons that FISA was adopted, and the Congress has spoken on the issue. Why Bush refuses to go back, even at this late stage, is it's an in-your-face approach, and I think if the Congress doesn't stand up and say in back to him, well, we just don't see it that way, and we want you to comply with the law, a censure is the way to do it.
John Schmidt,
you know, there's not a shred of evidence that this program has any of those Nixonian characters, that this involved wiretapping of newspaper reporters or staff members. This is a program run by professionals at the National Security Agency.
We don't know who's being tapped, right? I mean, there's no public, even congressional oversight of who's being tapped.
Well, no, there was originally briefing of the congressional leaders,
But did they tell them who? Do they tell them who? As far as I know, they
don't. I don't know if they give them names. I assume they describe the process that's used. General Hayden, even publicly, has said that the surveillance is limited to situations where they have reason to believe that one of the participants in the call has an al-Qaeda connection. And to suggest that this has something in common with Richard Nixon, I have to say, strikes me as just absurd. Richard Nixon was a participant in a criminal conspiracy to obstruct justice. He would have been indicted and almost certainly convicted had he not been pardoned. President Bush, by every account, acted on the basis of the legal advice he received from the Justice Department and the NSA. You can argue about that legal opinion, but to compare it to Richard Nixon, who was a criminal who would have gone to jail had he not been pardoned, seems to me to be a kind of argument that just doesn't advance any kind of serious understanding of these issues.
Bruce Fein, this was a big issue on Friday, the issue of bad faith, good faith, and the assertion, and John Schmidt's made it right here, that the president, whatever you think of it, has acted in good faith here trying to defend the nation.
Well, number one, we don't know whether he acted in good faith. Mr. Schmidt has no idea what legal advice Bush received. Bush has invoked executive privilege, so he's refused to disclose to Congress what legal advice he received. Moreover, there are elements that are not, you know, exact duplicates of Watergate that are very worrisome. The Congress has not been told even the number of Americans who have been targeted under the warrantless surveillance program. They have not been told exactly what is done with the surveillance material, whether it's destroyed, if it's innocuous or otherwise, where this has all been kept in the dark. And you could have equally said, Mr. Schmidt could have equally said about the 20 years of illegal mail openings by the CIA and FBI that led to FISA, the 20 years of illegal telegram interceptions by the CIA and the FBI that led to FISA, the 7 years of hijacking the NSA for criminal justice instead of foreign intelligence purposes that, well, there wasn't, we were all reassured at the time that everything that the professionals were doing were correct. The whole reason why you have transparency and checks is to ensure that there aren't abuses. As President Reagan said, trust but verify.
Let's take a call. Paul's calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm pleased to be here. In my view, the Republicans immediately went on the offensive after this news came out and tried to defend their argument on TV with every resource they had. The Democrats did not do that. As a result, the polls went in the favor of the Republicans and the president, and now the Democrats are leery of taking action. But
what should happen? What's the right thing? Never mind the politics for a moment, Paul.
Well, there's no question that Senator Feingold is correct, in my view, and there's no question that the president has exceeded his authority in a dangerous way to our Constitution, and the Congress should take action. And if they don't, as Senator Feingold said, they are complicit, and they'll regret not taking the action, just the way they regret not voting against the war today.
Let me turn to John Dean on that. Mr. Dean, how do you see Congress acting today as compared to 1972 and Watergate time?
Well, it's striking how inactive they are. Of course, there was divided government when Nixon was in the White House, but as I mentioned earlier, when I started on Capitol Hill, Democrats controlled both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue, and there was oversight. There were, much to Lyndon Johnson's chagrin, constant oversight of all of his programs, including his escalation of the war. So I don't understand why we have slowly yielded to the 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, where the downtown has everything to say and the Congress no longer has anything to say. That isn't exactly the way the founders contemplated it. And, you know, one of the true conservatives in this is, I hear, is Bruce Fein's voice. He wants to get back to the basics. And I'm for him.
John Schmidt, do you have any concern about the balance of power here, or are you feeling confident about it these days?
No, I do have a concern. I have actually supported, even before Senator Spector announced he was going to support it, the idea that it would be a good thing if a program like this could be submitted to a court for approval.
Utah Republican Orrin Hatch was pretty tough on John Dean on Friday. He questioned Dean here on a possible inconsistency in Dean's view.
Let me start with you, Mr. Dean. On September 14, 2001, just 3 days after the terrorist attack in America, you published an article titled Examining the President's Power to Fight Terrorism. Now, in that article, you argued that, quote, the President does not need congressional authority to respond, unquote.
Right.
Now, you wrote that Article 1, Section 8, which gives Congress the power to declare war, quote, does not put the Congress in charge of counterterrorism, which is an executive function, unquote. You also wrote, quote, yet as all his predecessors realized, when it gets down to how, when, and where to respond, the president can do whatever he feels necessary, whether Congress agrees or disagrees. Article 2, Section 1 has vested him with that power.
Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch putting it to John Dean on Friday. Mr. Dean, what about it? It sounded to a layman like Senator Hatch was landing a pretty good punch there. Just after 9/11, you said, go, President, go, do what it takes to defend us. Why is that not the case now?
Well, I didn't advocate in that article that any president had the power to go in the face of any statute that's already on the books. I said he has inherent power to fight terrorism, which indeed he has vast powers to do. That doesn't mean he has the power to violate the law. And there's nothing inconsistent about my position today and that one. And Hatch was just having fun taking it sort of out of context and using the argument that way.
John Schmidt, what about it? Can critics of the president have it both ways? Can they say, do what it takes to defend this country and stop this warrantless wiretapping?
Well, I've never understood how you can say the president has the authority, which almost everyone concedes, to respond to a terrorist attack in this country, but doesn't have the authority to carry out surveillance on where and when that attack is going to occur. And that's really all we're talking about here. In my view, it's a very narrow area of presidential power, but it's one that has come up over the years and where you know, courts have dealt with it and presidents have asserted it. And to say, you know, you've got the power and the responsibility to respond to attack, but you don't have the authority to carry out surveillance on where that attack is going to occur, to me makes no sense. I think it's the core of the president's power as commander-in-chief, and I think that's why Congress cannot encroach upon that power, even by passing a statute such as FISA.
Bruce Fein, what about it?
Well, I think the characterization as a narrow theory is utterly preposterous because there are many ways to gather foreign intelligence that Mr. Schmidt has neglected that would equally justify the president in far more muscular efforts. For example, his theory suggests the president could break and enter homes, notwithstanding FISA, because he says, I'm searching for foreign intelligence. And I said earlier, he could open mail. He could commit torture, all in the name of gathering foreign intelligence. It doesn't have any stopping point. Anytime he says, I'm searching for foreign intelligence, I can do anything I want, commit any crime, anything that Congress has made illegal, I can override. That's my inherent authority. And that's simply a ridiculous interpretation of executive power in a country that was calculated to divide power, to have checks and balances, to avoid tyrannies and repetitions of King George III. Now, with regard to this claim that FISA can be amended and it's unworkable, first of all, the administration itself in July of 2002 said FISA works splendidly. Moreover, the Attorney General says, with regard to domestic al-Qaeda to al-Qaeda calls, it isn't even using the warrantless surveillance program. It is using FISA, which discredits the idea that it's unworkable. And lastly, if what Mr. Schmidt is suggesting is done, maybe you need to amend FISA, his theory suggests the president can ignore it anyway, because his theory is any time you have collection of foreign intelligence involved, no matter what Congress says, any time, any place, anywhere, the president president could ignore it. So all the exercise that Congress might undertake, and which they have undertaken, in amending FISA five times since 9/11 is futile anyway, because the president can do whatever he wants.
Is censure the way to go here? Does it really make a difference? What's the impact of censure? It's so rare in American history.
I think the reason why censure can be constructive here is at least it's a signal to the courts of the United States that the Congress does not accept this utterly preposterous interpretation of executive branch powers. And therefore, if and when the case gets into the court system, we will not have a consensus between the political branches of what the president's power consists of. There's a dispute, and I think that will give more backbone to the court to repudiate what the president has done.
Let me take a call from Manhattan, Kansas. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello. It's just Manhattan, Kansas.
Thank you.
But anyway,
what
I have to say is, I mean, I'm for the censure because I don't believe for a second the censure will pass, but I think it needs to be debated openly in Congress. Now, my senator, Senator Roberts, who's the head of the Intelligence Committee, made a promise to have investigation, you know, to have a hearing on this, and then he reneged on his word. And because he reneged on his word and it's not going to be discussed any other way, then at least have the censure so people in Congress can talk about it.
But nobody's, I mean, very, very few lining up for it. Tom Harkin and is it Barbara Boxer? I mean, with Feingold, that's about it, David.
There's other political things. They're afraid that, you know, I guess the Democrats are afraid that if they have the censure, then the Republicans can line up next to it and line up their base, you know, who supports Bush.
John Schmidt, let me put it to you. Do you think censure is even the way to go? Is it the appropriate instrument for responding? Assuming people have the real concern, it's genuine. You don't agree, but if they do.
I think it's a crazy way to try to put this issue before Congress and the American people. I think it really is a distraction. There was a very good letter that came out over the weekend from Barack Obama, a Chicagoan, since I'm here in Chicago.
Illinois
speak
Senator,
on behalf
Democrat.
Of him. Yep. And he said he doesn't agree with me. He said, I don't think the president had the authority to do this. But he said this is an issue about which serious lawyers can disagree, and censure is inappropriate in these circumstances. And I think he has it exactly right. I think what Senator Specter is trying to do in amending the law, Senator Roberts, in defense of him, did back off on an investigation, but he did it only after the administration agreed to brief seven members of the Intelligence Committee. And they have begun to do that. And Senator Feinstein, for example, came out of that briefing and said, this is a very good program. I think it should continue.
John Dean, what about the politics around this and censure? You said Friday that it would put a brake on the administration in a way that you applaud, but a brake on what?
Well, my prepared statement, I actually said either amend the statute or censure. What I said is don't let there be a waiver. The point that Bruce was making, that you got to send a signal to the courts that the two political branches are just not going to roll over on this issue, and they shouldn't roll over. There are legitimate debates. I find it a real strain to rely on the kind of debate that or precedent that the administration is drawing on to make their case, but I just don't think there's any question that the censure is highly political, and if we could move it on to a more institutional basis and do something less than use those words, if the baggage, historical baggage of those words is too great, the Congress constantly is issuing documents of the sense of the Congress, the sense of the Senate. And they could do very easy in this case, say the sense of the Senate or the House is that we want the president to come to Congress and get this straightened out. He's not even willing to do that.
Bruce Fein, is it the too big a stick, too small, the wrong one?
Well, you can make political judgments one way or the other. The important point is the principle being established that Congress is not yielding yielding its powers unilaterally to the president and is standing up for checks and balances. Now, one of the things that's been neglected in this conversation so far with regard to President Bush is that if he had his way, we would never know about the program. His intent was to keep it secret forever, brief a few people, not on the real substance of the program, how many Americans were being targeted, what the yield was, but talk to a handful of folks saying, well, we're undertaking this program. That is not informing Congress to point two or three people. It wasn't even in compliance with the National Security Act, which requires the entire intelligence committees to be briefed. But his hope was to keep this entirely secret from the American people and from Congress forever. And it isn't a case where, in order to provide the information necessary for accountability to operate, that we were asking that he indicate what cable underneath the Atlantic Ocean was being tapped at a particular time that an Al-Qaeda call was being made. But to give an indication that he was flouting FISA, that he was not going to seek congressional authority, and he was undertaking this program for whatever reasons he says is national security, so that checks and balances could begin to work. His hope, however, was to leave office and no one would have known about it except a handful in the House and Senate who had a skeletal inkling of what was going on. That is very dangerous.
And now charges being raised, legal charges, are on the New York Times a publication of the story. John Schmidt, what about it? We're told this is the long war, a war where the endpoint is unclear and distant, we're told. What will constrain, what should constrain the executive in this kind of period of American history? Do you have any concern about it getting out of control?
Yeah, I do. I think oversight is important. When Bruce says the president briefed a few people, of course, those few were the Democratic and Republican leaders of the House and the Senate and the chairman and the ranking members of both of the intelligence committees.
But by all accounts, there's briefed very slightly there. I mean,
there's never been any suggestion, as far as I know, that they couldn't have asked additional questions. Jane Harman, the Democratic member in the House, has said she understood the program. But at this point, there is more extensive briefing, and that seems to me to be a good thing. If in fact, those leaders, those members of the Intelligence Committee didn't understand the program, then I think they were negligent in not going back and saying, you know, I want to understand this. I want to make sure this is working in a way that I think is appropriate.
But is the briefing now sufficient for the long term? Do we have a correct balance of power that this country can live with perhaps for decades?
Well, as I said, I would still like to see a court review of a program of this nature. The president has said, he asked his lawyers, why can't we do this under FISA? And they explained to him that it just couldn't work in the time frames that we were talking about. But had a program been able to be submitted, as would be true now under the law that Senator Spector is proposing, I think the president would have submitted this program. Everybody who has seen the program, everybody who's had the fuller briefing has come out and said this is a good program. I think that the court, based on what we know, at least, would have approved it, and we wouldn't be having this argument. I think that's better. It's not an alternative, but it's better to have a court look at it than to simply have members of Congress look at it who aren't necessarily capable of making the kind of legal judgment that's necessary.
I'd like to make one correction is Mr. Schmidt said that his lawyers advised him that FISA was not workable. His lawyers told the Senate Intelligence Committee July 31st, 2002, FISA was working flawlessly.
Is that we hear that and we've got it. Let's take a call from Canton, New York. Virginia's on the line. Hi, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well. What do you think, Virginia?
Well, I'm a U.S. citizen. My family. We've raised six children. We put President Bush in office. Mm-hmm. He is our leader. I entrusted him with the security of my home and my family, and I think that we're one country who demeans our leader, is constantly throwing mud back and forth between the departments, costing us more money. I trusted him to take care of us. After 9/11, I entrusted my life with him even more, and his decisions within the power that he has, and I believe that what we're doing now is creating even more problems. If the president can't wiretap my house and make me feel safe and I have nothing to hide, then I don't know where we're headed.
Virginia, let us pick it up. John Dean, what do you say to Virginia in New York State?
Well, I say that a lot of people have that reaction that I'm not doing anything, so they're welcome to wiretap me. That is halfway down the slippery slope. That is how we lose our liberties. Only a small group of people really seem to worry about the liberties that this nation takes for granted, and I'm thankful that they do. If we just sort of generally accepted and let our leaders do what they wished, I can promise you we'd lose our liberties. So the system is designed for ambitions on one branch to conflict with the other, and there couldn't be anything healthier in our process than for that to happen. And the day that stops happening, we're all in deep trouble.
And at the same time, you can hear Virginia loud and clear saying she wants to feel secure and defended. John Schmidt, so here we are. Is this going to end up in the right place, do you think? There's not a big head of steam on censure, so does it end up leaving the president with the power you think he needs?
Well, I thought the comment that was made by the reporter at the outset that what may happen is not censure, but that there is at least some movement towards some change in the law to create a judicial mechanism for approving a program of this kind, I think that would be a good thing. I do worry that this whole climate of opinion and the way people have reacted to this program could be inhibiting of a future president who is going to confront some crisis that we don't now know at all what it's going to be, and who knows what the technologies are going to be at that point. Mm. And when the question is, can he do what is necessary, he says, well, wait a minute, I don't want to get into that kind of a mess. Mm. We don't want that. Mm. And I think that's an issue that goes beyond the law into the climate of opinion and the way people talk about these issues. Mm. That's one reason I think talking about it in terms of censure is such a big mistake.
Bruce Fine, we've got 20 seconds here. Do you think we're going to come out of this long war with our civil liberties intact?
No, I think Congress is inclined to flinch with regard to the war issue that Mr. Schmidt mentioned. The fact is that FISA authorized the president for 15 days to do whatever he wants without warrants, and that can be altered to encounter the situation that he's described.
So watch out. And John Dean, your final word, the voice of history here?
May we not repeat it.
May we not repeat it. John Dean, with us from Los Angeles today, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Bruce Fine at Fine and Fine in Washington, thanks for being with us, Bruce.
Thank you.
John Schmidt at Mayor Brown, Roe, and Ma in Chicago. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.